Hello and welcome to That HR Podcast. Love might be in the air as we approach Valentine's Day, but today we're looking at slightly more strained relationships. Feathers will be ruffled and then tactfully smoothed back into place as we discuss conflict in the workplace.
And as the Six Nations gets underway, we will also reveal some of the fascinating links between HR and rugby. I'm Lily Howlett.
And I'm Siobhan Palmer, and today we're going to reflect our red, angry February magazine cover by asking, what exactly is your problem?
Whoa, that sounds a bit like you're trying to start a conflict.
Does it? Well, luckily we have CEO of UK Mediation, Dr. Mike Talbot here, to talk us through how to launder our language so we can handle workplace conflicts better. So hopefully I'll be able to phrase things more tactfully next time.
Yeah, well, you're always doing it though.
I never do it. But we also have Let's Go founder Richard Watkins with us to help us create conflict in a constructive way.
And if that wasn't enough scrumming for one day, John Slighthelm will enlighten us about his transition from playing professional rugby to running his own HR consultancy alongside his predictions for the Six Nations.
And Tim Poynter is back to advise another listener with their workplace worries in Tim's Pointers. That's all to come.
For some people, a conflict at work is a cold sweat inducing weapons grade nightmare fuel to be avoided at all costs.
But according to the CIPD's recent Managing Conflict at Work report, conflict is very much a part of organisational life. While it found that employers and employees are confident speaking up against conflict at work, when it comes to actually resolving it, there's still work to be done.
And this is a conflict conundrum in itself. It's great that people feel empowered to address conflict, but with no clear route of resolution in sight, how long before that confidence turns into a war of the words?
As workplace conflict is increasingly inevitable, Lily and I decided to learn from the experts how disagreements can be handled better and see if we could pick up some more effective techniques for dealing with office infighting. Joining us now is Richard Watkins, founder and director of Let's Go, a company helping businesses collaborate and work well together. Richard, you talk a lot about walking towards conflict and not being scared of disagreements at work. So Lily and I wondered whether you could show us some ways of navigating our own conflicts healthily.
I mean, I think the first thing to say about, I mean, I focus on collaboration, and of course, conflict is an inevitable part of collaboration, as we all know. And I think a really important thing is to think of conflict as generative, not destructive. That is, it has the possibility, if you think of what we're actually doing is we're saying me and you have conflicting views, that means just different, right? So if we have different views and we don't create a drama about the difference, actually we might learn something from each other. And so embracing a little bit of healthy conflict, rather than, again, there's a kind of myth out there that collaboration is about always being nice, and actually embracing a little bit of conflict is a way to get better ideas and to move things forward.
Lily and I actually thought, so we think the people management team should do something a little bit different for our Christmas party this year. So we thought maybe you could help us sort of, disagree about that.
I mean, I think that we should do zip lining for the Christmas party.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in the sort of theme of Christmas, we should maybe go and meet some reindeer.
Okay, great.
No.
So this is a good example. So the first thing to do is, if we have a conflict, is to realise that so much of our opposition to conflict is really when we get triggered about conflict. So, right, if it becomes a drama and it becomes ziplining versus reindeers and we want some kind of fight, or we think she's out to get me, she always says ziplining, but that's only because she's trying to undermine my good and strategically brilliant idea of reindeers. And so I think often if you think of conflict at work, the first thing to do is to work not with your intellectual system, which would say which is better, but to work with your nervous system, which is more like, am I calm? But a really important thing to do in this conflict is to make sure that you're not in your trigger state. And broadly, you can understand the nervous system as having two branches, a sympathetic, which is like a fight or flight nervous system, and then a parasympathetic, which is a rest and digest nervous system. We know what it feels like when we're in both, right? When we're hyper, we're ready to we're either going to run or fight, and it's lots of energy. And we also know what it's like to be calm, maybe a bit more playful, a bit more expansive. The good news is you can actually alter how you are. And one of the main ways you can do that is your breathing. So when you're anxious, your breathing gets faster or stuck. Sometimes you hold your breath. And you can hear that, right? When people are presenting, sometimes they're like that. But also it works the other way around as well, which is when you breathe calmly, you enter a calmer state. A really simplistic way to think about it is that whenever you breathe in, you energize yourself. And whenever you breathe out, you relax yourself. Right? So on a really simple level, something you can do, a little protocol you can do, is you can breathe out for longer than you breathe in, and then that will calm you down.
Okay.
So we could try it now. Like, let's say you're really anxious about your zip lining reindeer battle.
We've been saving this discussion for a while, yeah. So we are genuinely a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I can feel the tension in the room as well. The thing we have to do first is again, we can just do it really simply. And you can do this yourself without, it's not like something you need to do in a special moment, like everyone stop and let's do a breathing exercise. If you breathe in for four and you breathe out for six, so if you breathe in for four, one, two, three, four, and you breathe out for six, one, two, three, four, five, six.
Nearly passed out.
Right.
I do feel actually a bit serene though.
If you do that for about 4 or 5 minutes, you will notice that that will bring you down into a calmer state. So that's a really good practice. You can do it when you're in a stressful meeting. You can do it live in a situation rather than something like meditation, which is also good for your nervous system, but it's something you do, it's more like muscle building outside of a situation. So we're nice and calm. And then what we can do is, I spent a long time working in innovation, and there's a lot there about building on ideas. And so there's an improv technique called yes and, which is where you're always building on the other person's idea. So for example, you're saying reindeers, and then we would say yes and, that would be great, and you're kind of really trying to encourage and build up that idea. I worked for an agency called What If, and they had a concept called greenhousing, which is really like the practice of deliberately doing that with all ideas. So you create a little greenhouse around a fragile idea so it doesn't get stamped on, right? And so in greenhousing, we would build up those two ideas. But the truth is, if you're trying to bring about something in an organization, it's also going to face criticism. So we used to have this thing we would say on our innovation projects, we'd say, you know what, sometimes what you need is to do shithousing. And that is to attract a bit of conflict, but in a calm way. So we kind of looking at all the potential problems with the different ideas.
So really trying to kind of, not in a mean way, of course, but tear down the other idea.
Exactly. And to throw stones at it. And so what we could do then is we could start and we could work with, let's say, the zip wire, and let's all together try and throw stones at that idea.
Okay.
Right?
Bring it on.
So it's really then you're kind of letting go of it as your idea, and you're saying, okay, let's just embrace a bit of conflict here. And the idea is that then we'll learn something about it.
Okay.
Right, so zip wire, everyone could die.
It's not very Christmassy.
That's true.
Okay.
What else could be wrong about the zip wire?
Well, I suppose some people might not want to do it.
Why would they not want to do it?
People might be afraid of heights or afraid of jumping. Just, you know, it's a high energy exercise.
Is it? Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of,
well, I mean,
it's not
going to be cold.
Dangerous, a bit cold. Now let's look at the reindeer idea. I mean, I don't want to get bitten by a reindeer.
What if I'm allergic to a reindeer?
Yeah, allergies. It's for you. What would be reasons
so
to
we
not...
have to kind of
you're like entering,
you know,
into
throw stones at
our own idea.
Well.
Exactly. This is basically the heart of it, because we're trying to de-escalate my idea, your idea. We're just trying to throw stones at all the ideas.
Well, I suppose, yeah, there could be, you could get an infection from a reindeer. Could be some kind of reindeer flu that could go around, like bird flu.
We're dealing with a slightly hypothetical example, but you can begin to say maybe another criticism of the reindeer idea would be, again, we've kind of already heard it a little bit, but maybe people wouldn't want to go there. Maybe it's far away. I don't know if it's expensive to go. Mm. So you can start to play with these ideas, and you can do that obviously with different kinds of ideas, but you might get to something like, well, what do we then, when we start throwing those stones at those ideas, what do we learn about how to make those ideas stronger?
It's interesting. It does feel quite sort of new to get your own idea and say, well, this is why it's rubbish. You're used to defending your idea and wanting to make it kind of successful, so it's a new experience. How do you feel about it? I feel a bit traitorous to my reindeer.
So how do you get to a point where, because obviously if you're throwing stones at an idea, is there a worry that you're going to get caught in this sort of neggy cycle? Is there's a lot of businesses that just champion positivity over everything else. So how do you then turn that back around?
If we know that we're in it together, like if we can look each other in the eye and say, you know, we're on the same side, we want a good Christmas party, we've got different ideas, let's, and we could do the other side as well, we could build the ideas up together, but also like embracing a bit of conflict. Because let's say you're the Christmas party committee, even if you two agree, you're going to take those ideas to the rest of the team, and some of them are not going to want to, whatever one of those two you decide, some people are not going to like it. So part of it is about getting used to these uncomfortable feelings. Like, actually, what is it when someone tramples on my idea or suggests a problem with my idea? And can I embrace that in a calm way? And so in a way, this kind of exercise is more like sparring for ideas. It's not like a fight because we're on the same side. And sparring in boxing is to prepare you so that when you go into the fight, you're not afraid of being hit. Because again, I don't know how aggressive the rest of the people management team are about Christmas ideas.
Aggressive.
But you can imagine, like, let's take it to a business scenario, like maybe a higher stakes project. People are going to be resistant to change or resistant to ideas. And if you've already experienced what some of those resistances are, you can say, well, actually, we've investigated that zip wiring is safe. We've found a place to do it that's warm. We know that the reindeers aren't in Greenland. We've got some locally. They're hypoallergenic reindeers. And so if you like, then by attracting problems, you can then strengthen the ideas.
Yeah.
And then when you go out, you're expecting someone to tell you that they're allergic to reindeers because you've already kind of imagined it rather than only imagining a best case scenario.
As we've discovered, thanks to Richard, inviting conflict is clearly important in the workplace, but handling it well is just as important. With us now is Dr. Mike Tolbert, CEO of UK Mediation, which helps companies resolve conflicts of all shapes and sizes by providing an impartial third-party representative to work through the problems. Mike, we've been shown ways of encouraging conflict, and admittedly, it felt a little unnatural to us, didn't it? but can you explain how you help people disagree well?
I think, you know, disagreement's inevitable. Where you get two different people in the same workplace or neighbourhood or squash club or committee, you're going to get conflict. And it's a lively, energetic, useful, creative force for change and innovation. You know, so conflict is okay. And I think that's some of the themes that you've been covering already. But I think where we get people coming in with very different expectations or different values or different histories, either in a workplace or from previous workplaces, we can get clashes. Maybe a clash of values, maybe a clash of language, it may be a clash of expectation. It may just be some kind of personality clash, which is down to the psychology of the individuals that we can't really get into in a workplace. It's something rather deeper. But what we do in mediation and what we do in conflict resolution, thinking about, you know, encouraging healthier conflict, is one of the things we can do is very simply just look at language and look at how people talk to each other. And I think there's a few key things that we can address in terms of language that can actually unstick a lot of conflicts that would otherwise get really entrenched and really quite sticky. One of the things I come across quite a lot is the use of always and never. And, you know, we and our loved ones, of course, would never get into arguments when we get into always and never about always leaving the toilet seat up or never emptying the dishwasher or never taking the dog for a walk. So it's where you get to. It's just an expression of anger. You know, I'm fed up with you and I'm just going to label you as an always and a never. So I think, you know, that's one of the things that we can very, very simply address. So, like, if I could give you a little example. So let's think about Sarah talking to Tom. Okay, so they're coming to the manager's office, or the manager overhears a conversation between Sarah and Tom. And she says, look, you never include me in any of the office banter. You always say hello or good morning to everyone else before me. I'm sick of it. Okay, now where's that going to go? It's not going to go anywhere, really, because always is always and never is never. I make the assumption that nothing never happens and nothing always happens. So imagine you're the manager overhearing that. You know, so what I'd want to do is sort of try and change those always and nevers and do what we call a little bit of reframing. So I'm not changing the language. I'm not interpreting. I'm not representing or advocating for either of the two parties in this conflict. I just want to turn it into something a little bit more constructive. So I might say something like, hey, Sarah, you know, you really need things to change. You want Tom to include you in office banter and to have a sense that he's treating you just like everyone else, including things like greetings and so on. Does that sound different? You know, does it sound a little bit more like there's a door open to some possible resolution there? Because you've gone away from the always and the nevers, and you're looking at what Sarah needs from Tom. So it's a good example, I think, of just a linguistic blocker. Always and never tend to be linguistic blockers.
Lily and I have had our own conflict. We've been talking a lot recently about what we think the people management team should do for our Christmas party.
Okay.
And we're we're pretty at odds on this new plan. Yep. Maybe you could help us. I've heard you call it laundering your language. Can you help us kind of, you know, maybe find a resolution and stop being...
Well, I don't know if we're... it being the first week in February, but, you know, so it's important we get this right.
Plan ahead, always.
When people get into standoffs, I think there's a few things that, a few simple things that we can address. I think one of them is about just the ways that we talk to each other, using things like "but." So we're having an exchange, and we're sort of talking to each other in a way that uses "but." Now, let me give you a phrase. Let's suppose that I'm talking to somebody, and I said, "Okay, let me try and bring it around to your example." Then, what's one of your ideas about where you're going to go for your Christmas do?
Well, we both like to do something a little different. I think we should go and meet some reindeer.
And okay. I want to go zip lining.
And you want to go zip lining.
Yeah. Okay.
So you want to go meet some reindeer, but you want to go zip lining.
Yeah.
Okay, and then hear this. So you want to meet some reindeer and you want to go zip lining. Do they sound different?
Yeah.
Now, with a "but," what you tend to do is erase everything that went before. So I've kind of discounted the meeting reindeer proposition by using the "but," before I've turned to the zip lining proposition. So "but" tends to erase everything that went before.
Yeah.
And when you've got two people whose ideas and whose aspirations are entirely, completely, equally valid in the room, you know, as a practitioner, I want to make sure that I'm not seen to be partial and that I'm taking one person's side or another. So if you came to me with this crucial dispute, I'd want to make sure that you want to meet some reindeer and you want to go zip lining. And then we'd look at what it is about those two endeavours that you would enjoy. Hmm. And possibly we'd end up with something that satisfied both of your needs at the same time. So the idea is the "and" keeps both sets of hopes and aspirations in the room at the same time, but tends to erase one set of aspirations and needs at the exclusion of the other.
So when I sort of storm up to our editor and say, "Look, we really want to do this Christmas party. I really think we should meet some reindeer, but Lily wants to go ziplining."
Okay, you've just discounted Lily's wishes.
You're discounting me when you say that.
Now, guys, look, I'm very reasonable, but, you know.
So instead, I should try and say, "We've got a huge problem. I want to go meet some reindeer, and Lily wants to go ziplining." Yeah, I can hear the difference, actually. Yeah. It makes it all both still sound possible.
Yeah, sure. It makes me feel included when you say "and."
Okay, so we've tried our hand at some ways of making conflict at work a more positive and productive experience, and I have to say, I learned a lot. I've definitely been in some workplaces where these techniques weren't in use, to be honest, and I'm sure some of our listeners will have too.
Well, we've got Mike and Richard with us now to discuss conflict in UK workplaces more generally. Thanks for being here, both of you, and thank you for teaching us ways of embracing and managing conflict.
So we've talked a bit and we've learnt a bit about different types of conflict and making conflict healthy. But when we're talking about positive conflict, how do you identify that? If there's, for example, someone in an organisation that is attracting a lot of conflict, how do you know if that's a problem or if maybe that person's just actually being really constructive and having lots of ideas?
Okay, well for me, in a sort of conflict sense, I think it's about people having different ideas or different ways of approaching the same ideas. So positive conflict can give rise to innovation and new ideas, new ways of thinking about things. A negative conflict mostly comes when people start getting into mind reading and expectations about what others think of them or expectations about others' beliefs and values, which are not necessarily accurate. So when you get into that mind reading place, we get into what we call projection, and people start to infer other people's motives, which are often negative, second guess what other people are thinking or feeling, and it gets into a rather strained situation where communication breaks down. So I would say positive conflict is usually indicated by lively dialogue, people having different opinions, people bringing their different beliefs and values to the tables and coming up with new ideas. Negative conflict is where it's rather more tight-lipped and rather more tense, when you get into a very tightly configured situation, by which I mean a bit like a very tightly wound ball of string, and there's no strands hanging out, there's nothing to sort of unravel it with, there's nothing to loosen up the situation with. So there's a sense you can almost walk into an office sometimes, or walk into a mediation, as I do many times, and you get a feeling of, is this very tightly configured, there's nothing happening, there's no ideas being exchanged, or are we in a situation where it's just a lively and healthy exchange of views?
And once a conflict, and I'm imagining kind of with your work, often you're coming in when there's a full conflict, I think one of the things that's interesting in workplaces is actually the other side is often a real repression of anyone saying what they really think or feel. And that's, I mean, even when I was early in my career, you were talking about conflict aversion. And I think I was always very, I always wanted to be, you know, collaborative and work with people. And I didn't yet see the power of actually just being really honest and truthful. I was working with one of my mentors early on in my career, and he used to be really happy to walk into conflict, but did it in this really calm way. And what he used this phrase that really stuck with me, where you go into a situation where someone said something, and instead of going against the other person, he would just be like, oh, that's really interesting, I've got another view. And then he would propose a very different version of events or a very different opinion about what was to do next. And I actually kind of used that, I kind of grabbed that phrase a little bit and used it quite a lot. Like, someone's put forward an idea that I don't agree with. Rather than seeing myself as having to go against this other person, I go, oh, I've got that's amazing. Well, isn't it great that you see it that way? Look, here's how I see it. And it's really different to that. And so this I have another view is quite a nice tool, if you like, a linguistic tool to just actually unearth some of these differences. Because when the differences are alive, it's normally pretty obvious, if we've got good intentions for each other, which are the ones that are going to live and which are the ones that are really going to help us. Because most people have got an interest in doing what's going to work or what's the right thing for us to do as a group or as a organization. And if you can air the alternatives, then the sort of sunshine is the best disinfectant. You can kind of see something of what's needed.
So, Mike, you help all kinds of different employers settle their differences. And I just wondered, what's the biggest sort of misconception or barrier that people have when it comes to workplace conflict?
I think, unfortunately, in a lot of organisations, is that you have to treat it formally. Something's happened, you know, somebody comes to a manager with a complaint about a colleague, or they go to the HR department because they're concerned about somebody else's conduct. Out comes the grievance form. Okay, stage one, stage two grievance. Here we go. Let's record everything and speak to witnesses. Let's get it down. Dates, times, places. That's probably the biggest mistake that people make. And as a mediator going into organisations, I think it's, mediation is a very, very simple thing. It's just getting people to have a chat. And it's very successful as well. But where it fails is usually where people have either left it too long before they've done anything about a conflict, or they've gone formal too quickly. Conflict doesn't blow over if it's left unaddressed. So the best thing to do to it, as we're very much saying, is walk towards it in a positive way with some skills, with some confidence. Like Richard's saying, you know, it's that confidence of being able to go into a room to pose a different view. It doesn't mean that because I've got a different view that I've got it in for you or I don't like it. So I think the biggest mistake that people make, or the biggest misconception that people have, is conflict is necessarily damaging. It necessarily has to be dealt with formally, and it necessarily has to be dealt with in a very win-lose way where somebody's right and somebody's wrong. And my take on that is that nobody's right and nobody's wrong, really. And to come back to what Rich is saying about, you know, kind of favourite phrases or favourite ways of approaching stuff, my favourite phrase as a mediator is, you're probably not going to agree about what's happened up to this point. And I just love to say it and see how people's faces change. Because they can't, the faces go, oh yeah, you're right. We've been banging our heads together for 18 months trying to prove who's right and who's wrong, and actually we're not going to agree. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's the practitioner, Richard or me or anyone else, setting up the right environment so that people can feel that they can let go of their version of events. Mm-hmm. The misconception is I have to hang on to that and I have to try and prove I'm right, and that's the way to get through this situation. Actually, if you set up an environment where you can let go of that history without feeling as if you've lost face, without feeling that you've compromised your dignity by letting go of your version of history, then that's a really good way to start to move forwards with a conflict.
A professor from Kellogg Management Institute called Cynthia Wang, who did an interesting experiment, which kind of relates to that, but it sort of says something maybe a bit counterintuitive or a bit of another view than what we've been talking, which is that when someone's preparing to collaborate with someone, the way that they set up the experiment, they said, oh, you're going to be collaborating with this person and they're of the opposite political persuasion than you are. What that does is sets up some anxiety because they think, well, I won't agree with this person. But what's interesting is they actually saw more productive collaborations because both of those people prepared more, maybe with a bit of this anticipation that there would be some difference. But actually that anticipation that there might be difference or that there might be conflict can sometimes be helpful, because if I assume that, oh, we're the same, we're both from IT, we're gonna be together, and actually then we do come up with conflict, we can be surprised, and then that can take us into that more fight or flight response where we think we've been slighted or something because we weren't ready for it. And so I think there's both how you face it when you're in there, but also being prepared that it might happen, and not seeing that as a massive surprise.
There's another misconception about conflict that I have to mention, which is that the symptom is the problem. So quite often what managers or HR practitioners, with greatest respect, will see of a conflict is just the symptoms, when actually there's something more that's going on. And having mediated, I'm going to sound like an old guy here, but having mediated about 1,200 disputes over the last 21 years, I can tell you something that keeps coming up in workplace disputes is about tea making.
Really?
Really. So it's a very, very common thing. So a group of people in an office where one person feels that nobody ever makes me a cup of tea. A group where somebody will make tea for three, somebody else will make tea or coffee for the other four, and people start to read things into this. Well, why are they only doing their teas and they're not doing our teas? A situation I worked with where somebody read volumes into the fact that an individual in the group would never accept tea from this person, but would accept tea from everybody else. And he said, well, what's that yeah. about? Why have they got it in for me? They won't take tea for, and she started to, she got quite obsessive about it and started to record, you know, make a little note, little mark on the pad every time she offered this individual this tea, and each time the individual refused it from herself, but accepted it from other people. Anyway, when it came to a head, it turned out that the person who was declining the tea said, you know what, I've said to you, I want a drop of milk, I want a splash of milk, I want a dot of milk, and you still go glug, glug, glug with the milk. She said, I can't stand your tea. It's horrible.
And that got to a mediation setting, all about the way they made tea.
It's the symptom, it wasn't the disease. There was more going on beneath the surface, but this was the way that it popped up. This is the way it came out.
I wonder if that's specific to British offices in particular.
Yeah. I do have a foolproof method for tea making in the office, actually, that can bypass all conflict. And this is basically avoids you having to offer every single person in the office a tea. It's that you always, whenever you make yourself a cup of tea, make two. And then you come back into the office and you say, I've got a spare tea. Does anyone want it?
Hey.
And what happens is you get universal brownie points because everyone's like, oh, mate, oh, but no one feels bad that they didn't get one.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having this discussion, guys. Yeah. You heard it here first. To avoid conflict in the workplace, be open about tea.
Yeah. And make a spare cup.
With the Six Nations well underway and the people management offices based in the motherland of English rugby, Twickenham, we thought it would be a bit lapsus of us not to mention the rugby. The problem is, HR and rugby, they seem like chalk and cheese. They might both involve a lot of scrums and butting heads, but the two couldn't be more opposite. Or can they?
In 1997, John Slighthelm had no idea that a future in human resources was waiting in the wings for him, as he played wing for Premiership Rugby Union sides Bath Rugby and Northampton Saints, and represented his country playing for England in the 96 and 97 Six Nations, as well as in international test matches. Since his retirement in 2004, John found himself at a crossroads. Unsure of the right journey to take, he founded a career transition business for retired sports people and began to dip his toe in the sea of business management. This led him to headhunting, recruitment, and eventually people management. But how did it all click into place? And is there anything HR can take away from rugby? I gave John a call and asked him about how he transitioned from professional rugby to HR.
I guess, like a lot of people, not necessarily planning that journey exactly in terms of the destination. I was in 2004 when I actually retired from professional rugby. I had a few opportunities to look at. I guess what the biggest challenge is for a lot of people exiting elite professional sport is not the opportunities not being there. There are opportunities, but it's which is the right door to walk through. Because trying to replace what you've been doing as a professional sports person is very, very difficult, nigh impossible. So to try and find the right opportunity is, I guess, a challenge that a lot of sports people have. And quite shortly after I retired, that's exactly what I ended up doing, which was creating a business, a career transition business, essentially, which was focused on working with elite and professional sports people through the journey to what they were going to be doing next post-retirement. And what you find with most elite professional sports people, albeit it's better now than it ever was 16 years ago, is that not all of them, actually very few of them, are planning their exit from elite and professional sport. And bar the only, you know, the very, very top few percent of them, you know, are not financially secure and stable when they retire as well. So, they, you know, in other words, they have to earn a living. And it's an odd one because you get to your early 30s in professional sports and you kind of peaked in your career and you peaked in terms of your earning potential. Whereas people in a normal career pathway, they're just starting to really hit their stride in their early 30s. So that's really how I sort of fell into the people piece quite early. I guess coming from a team sport, coming from rugby, always been sort of fascinated with, I guess, psychology of teams and what makes teams tick and how you get lots of different individuals together with different personalities and different traits to get to achieve a common goal. So I guess there'd always been an interest in how the sort of humans interact with each other. Mm-hmm. So that was the first sort of 5 or 6 years post retirement for me. I then went off into what you would call more traditional recruitment world and headhunting, which I enjoyed. And part of the reason for wanting to do that was to sort of expand my experience overseas. I was approached by actually a client that we were working with at the time who was interested in employing sports people into their organisation and the DNA of sports people, which is quite transferable into the business world, you know, that resilience and, you know, work ethic, etc., that lots of, you know, employers look for.
You've learned, you know, an invaluable set of skills during your professional rugby career. Did any of those, like, sort of seamlessly transfer into HR?
Yeah, they did, and I think one of them was playing a team sport, particularly rugby. It brings in people from lots of different backgrounds. People from, you know, there's an old say, an old cliche that, you know, everybody's equal when they walk through the door of a rugby club, and it's largely true. Rugby has people from all backgrounds, all socioeconomic backgrounds, all walks of life. You know, you'd be playing rugby with doctors and consultants and lawyers and equally guys who were, you know, putting a spade in the ground for a living. So there was a huge, diverse group of people. So I think those were the real lessons I took from rugby into the people world, into the HR world, because it gave me a real sort of leg up of understanding that there are lots of different people that can provide lots of different skills and experience to an organisation. They might not all, you know, be the same personality trait, they might not all be the same, they might not all like the same things, but they all can deliver their part of what is, you know, the bigger goal of what the organisation is trying to achieve. And that's very much what a rugby team is all about. Everybody's got a different job in that team, and everybody works towards a common goal. And those are the major lessons, really, that you've got lots of diverse people with lots of different personalities, and you can gel those individuals together towards a common goal.
So it sounds as though what happened is that you kind of almost fell into HR.
I did, certainly in 2004 when I retired, I would have never turned around and said I want to be the HR lead of a large multinational organisation, which is where I ended up being. But I guess I was very clear on my career goals at 19 and 20. That was about playing sport at the highest level. In fact, actually, my career in rugby sort of was half and half. I was half in the amateur area, and in 1995-96, the game of rugby union went professional, so we became professional rugby players, but I'd qualified to be a teacher. So I guess going back to your question about why HR, well, the people thing goes right back to me being 17 or 18, knowing that I wanted to teach. There's a link there for me in terms of understanding people, educating people, working with people and getting people towards, you know, achieving whether it be a business goal, a sports goal, or an education goal. So there's always been that interest in what makes people tick, what makes people work, and how to get the very best out of people. And when you step into an elite sports environment, you find that, you know, that is such a high level of, you know, that you're working with, the type of people you're working with. And I guess that's one of the lessons that I learned, I guess probably the hard way, about going from sport into the business world as well, is that in an elite sports environment, everybody is pulling out everything that they absolutely can to achieve the common goal, which is winning a game that weekend or going on to win, you know, the championship at the end of the season. Everybody's pulling in the same direction. If they're not, they're usually jettisoned very quickly from that group. I guess one of the lessons I learned early on in the business world was that's not necessarily always the case outside of that elite sports environment. And I got frustrated on a number of occasions where people didn't have that sort of ambition. And it took a while for me to the paint up, think, actually, everything's different with that as well. Some people really want to strive to be exceptional and push themselves in everything they do, like people in professional elite sport do, but not everybody's like that outside of those environments. So I quickly learned that I had to sort of accept that and understand that everybody's, you know, some people are happier operating at that level and they don't want to push themselves any further than that. And that's absolutely fine. That's what people choose to do.
Obviously, England lost to France, which I think we're all a bit disappointed with the Six
Nations.
Yes,
we are.
By the time that the episode is going to come out, I think England would have played their second game against Scotland. Do you have any predictions for that game and obviously the Six Nations in general?
Well, I think England will bounce back from the defeat in France at the weekend. It was a disappointing first half performance from England, and they came off the back of what had been a successful World Cup up until obviously losing in the final against South Africa. Oh. I'm expecting to see a big reaction from England this weekend. I think in terms of the overall for the Six Nations, I think we saw a really, really good performance from France yesterday. I think some of the demons that France have had as a team over the last few years seem to have been put to bed by their new coaching team, who seem to be getting the very best out of what has always been a very talented group of individuals, but culturally not been quite right, and sort of attitude-wise. And there's always been the, you know, as an English player looking at playing against France, you would always, you know, talk about how the French, which French side was going to turn up. Again, it's a rugby cliche, but it's true. You know, they have all the talent in the world. I think they're, having beaten England yesterday, I think they could go on to big things this year in the Championship. I felt before the games at the weekend that nobody would win a Grand Slam this year. Nobody would go unbeaten. I thought whoever came out in the England-France game on top would probably go on to win the Championship. And I'll stick by that. I think France are going to be a real challenge and a real force to be reckoned with this season.
And now we have the man who stops you HRPing on about your problems. It's Tim Poynter. How are you doing, Tim?
See, you mentioned a harp and immediately I'm thinking about having a pint.
Are you there?
So it's a case of, like, you know, it's a cool, sharp harp. Anyway, yes, very good, thank you, but suddenly thirsty.
Oh, I was trying to tie it in with Valentine's Day with a nice little harp and the Cupid.
I can see what you're arrowing towards now.
Oh, well, shall we get straight to it, Tim?
Let's do it.
Okay, well, we've had someone write in with a problem here. I manage a small HR team within a mid-sized company. 4 people report to me and 6 report to my colleague. There is a good dynamic in my team and we work together well. Everyone's friendly. Recently, one of the people I line manage struck up a romantic relationship with a new member of the L&D team. This person doesn't report to me, but they report to my colleague. They do work together on projects from time to time and we all sit in the same office. The person that I manage revealed this relationship to me as we have a good professional relationship and she wanted to be transparent. However, the company at large frowns upon employees getting into relationships, so she's asked me not to tell anyone else. I'm uncomfortable with this situation and not sure what to do. I don't want to break my staff members' confidence, but I also feel like it might be useful information for others to know about it. It could lead to problems down the line, especially in terms of preferential treatment or unprofessional conduct. I don't want to put either employee's job in danger, but I'm not sure how management will respond to the news. Please help us, Tim.
All this is, there are so many bits here.
There's a lot there.
So many bits. There are certain phrases that I just love. Frowns upon. What does frowns upon look like? Does it mean we have a policy in place? Or is it just a cultural, oh, we're not a big fan of that? Because there's a massive difference between the two. All organisations should strive, and the vast majority do, to have a no surprises culture. We know if we do X, Y happens. Whereas if it's all sort of like nudges and winks, we don't know what the rules of the game are. Some organisations have very clear rules on relationships at work. Many of our listeners will remember the case in November last year when Steve Easterbrook, the global CEO of McDonald's, was exited because he had a relationship with one of the team.
Yeah.
So really clear protocols in place, breached, he knew X equals Y, he leaves the business. Mm. Now, if you're in that situation, then unfortunately our correspondent has put themselves in a difficult situation because they have agreed, it sounds to me, not to tell anyone else.
Mm.
If we're more in the sort of like, no one really thinks that's a great idea, then it's more difficult to understand what the situation is here. But firstly, I would say we all as leaders have to try and not put ourselves in situations where we feel that we have a secret that puts us in a really difficult situation. Anyone that works as a mentor or a coach knows the word contracting, where we're really clear at the start of a working relationship, we're clear as to what's confidential and what's not. Mm. And it's the same in leadership roles. We have to be clear there's some information which will stay just between the two of us. But if there is information which is in breach of a company rule or protocol that we both know is an issue, then it can't stay between us. And I think this is where there is an awful lot of unease here. And so, and just from a human point of view, all of us that have seen office relationships, since when did they ever stay secret?
Yeah.
Come on. It's like, oh yeah, because no one knows. The office knows. Trust me. As human, you know, as human beings, we are incredibly attentive to all the details. There is no way this isn't the source of office gossip already. So there's two sides here. There's the human relationship about how people are around one another. Mm-hmm. People are already talking about this, trust me. And there's the have we got a clear company approach to it that we need to get involved with. And if you're in that management situation, my advice would be go back to the individual and say, I've given it some thought. We need to work this through in an adult to adult situation, because people are going to find out really quickly. They're going to see you out and about together. It happens. I've had this at work with my boss dating someone in the team. And get, you know, it gets very awkward very quickly, and you just need to get this information out quickly and deal with it quickly.
Well, I think that we're going to be able to collaborate on our Christmas party ideas a lot better now.
Yeah, we're going to take some deep breaths and we're going to tear the ideas down, but be less personal about it. And I think we're going to resolve conflicts in a healthy way.
That's all from That HR Podcast today. A big thank you to our guests, Richard Watkins, Dr. Mike Tolbert, John Slightholm, and of course, Tim Poynter.
You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. Keep up to date on all things HR and That HR Podcast on our website, peoplemanagement.co.uk. And don't forget to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to see your comments.
Once again, I'm Lily Howlett.
And I'm Siobhan Palmer. The producer for this episode was Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.